Chapter 6. The First Hurdle. We peaked at the perfect time in the 87-88 season, capturing 10 of our final 13 games. With a record of 50-32, we tied the Atlanta Hawks for second place in the Central Division, only 4 games behind the Pistons. 7 of those last 10 victories were on the road, which was encouraging. The road hadn't always been friendly to us. One reason for our success was the play of Sam Vincent, the point guard acquired from Seattle shortly before the trade deadline. While Sam could score, his job was to get the ball to Michael, and he did that very well. In 29 games with the Bulls, he averaged more than 8 assists. To obtain Sam, we had to get rid of Saddle. No one was surprised. I felt a little disappointed to see him go, though the two of us were never as tight as Doug believed. Our opponent in the opening round of the playoffs was the 6-seeded Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cavs were extremely talented. They had a young center to build around in Brad Doherty, the number one overall selection in the 1986 draft, along with forwards Larry Nance and Hot Rod Williams, and guards Mark Price, Ron Harper, and Craig Elo. Their coach was Lenny Wilkins, who led the Sonics to a title in 1979. Magic Johnson would dub the Cavs the team of the 90s. Magic was a man of many gifts. Being able to see the future wasn't one of them. We jumped out to a 2-0 lead at the stadium, with Michael doing his best imitation of Wilt Chamberlain, 50 points in game one, followed by 55 in game two. Of course, he took 80 shots in the 2 games combined. The rest of the team took 118. The Cavs took the next 2 in Cleveland, holding Michael to 82 points to set up a deciding Game 5 in Chicago. The first round in those days was a best 3 out of 5. While warming up, I got myself prepared for when Doug would summon me from the bench. Pretty early, I figured. Except for Game 3, Brad Sellers had not been having an especially productive series. Over the first 4 games, I averaged about 25 minutes. That's a lot of minutes for a backup. Only I would be a backup no longer. Roughly a half hour before the opening tip, Doug told me I would start instead of Brad. He's got to be kidding, I thought to myself. I didn't start a game the whole year, and not once in the 3 days since game 4 did he give the slightest indication a change might be coming. I was ready for the challenge, don't get me wrong, although the logic escaped me then and still does. Why now, after I had come off the bench for 79 regular season games and 4 playoff games, was Doug having me take on a new role in what was, to that point, the most important game of my life? Doug never explained his logic. He didn't have to. He was the coach. I was a player. I did what I was told. I believe he was concerned that, my being a rookie, the moment might be too big for me if I knew a day or two ahead of time. If that indeed was his reasoning, he couldn't have been more mistaken. Keeping me in the dark was another sign of how little he respected me. I wasn't some punk from the local Y. I played 4 years of college basketball and had been a starter since the middle of my freshman season. No moment was too big for me. Being a starter requires a different mindset from coming off the bench. Memo to Doug. It would have been helpful to have a day, heck, a few hours, to put myself in that mindset. As it turned out, I fared quite well, scoring 24 points to match my high for the year. I went 10 of 20 from the field and finished with 6 rebounds, 5 assists, and 3 steals. Most important, we won the game 107-101 to extend our season. We dug ourselves a huge hole in the first quarter, trailing by 18 points. Then Michael, despite hurting his knee, got hot in the second quarter to cut into that deficit. We seized our first lead of the game in the third after I stole the ball from Ron Harper and went in for a layup. The Cavs made a run down the stretch until Michael, who finished with 39 points, hit 2 free throws to put it away. The fans in Chicago finally had something to celebrate. The Bulls hadn't won a playoff series in 7 years. It was just the beginning. On a personal level, I felt vindicated. I should have been starting ahead of Brad from day one. Anyway, it was on to Detroit for the Eastern Conference semifinals. The Pistons were the clear favorites. In game one, they played like it, holding us to 82 points. They scored 93. Their center, Bill Laimbeer, was outstanding. 16 points and 14 rebounds. I was not. 2 points and 3 rebounds. We earned a split by winning game two, 105-95, thanks to 36 points from Michael and 31 from Sam Vincent. Oak added 10 points and 12 boards. Everything went downhill from there. In Chicago, we couldn't manage to score 80 points in either game. The Pistons took Game 3, 101-79, and Game 4, 96-77. They put us out of our misery in Game 5. The final, 102-95. The only positive from the season coming to an end was that I could give my back a much-needed rest. The Pistons, as physical as they were, vicious might be a more accurate way to put it, were the worst possible team to play if you're not at 100%. Every drive down the lane, every scramble for a loose ball, felt more like rugby than basketball. Friedrich Nietzsche, the 19th century German philosopher, said that if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. Mr. Nietzsche never met Bill Laimbeer. The guy was a thug. Unfortunately, the rest did my back more harm than good. That's what led to my seeking the second opinion from Dr. Schaefer and the diagnosis of a herniated disc. I would need to have surgery. I was scared. What if the operation went poorly? I was warned by family and friends you should never let someone cut you open, the risk of permanent damage being too great. I had come so far since Coach Wayne kicked me off the team in high school that I began to wonder, had the basketball gods been toying with me all along, setting me up for the cruelest of fates? That my career in the NBA, my dream, would be one and done? In July 1988, I put any fears aside and went through with the surgery. I was willing to do anything to get rid of the pain that was running my life. The operation went smoothly, according to the doctors, who were optimistic I would make a full recovery. I wasn't so sure, especially in the first couple of weeks, when I couldn't move my right leg and the pain in my back remained constant and sharp. They assured me this was a normal response to the procedure. Easy for them to say. My future was on the line, not theirs. I thought of Ronnie and Dad, and how they spent day after day trapped in a wheelchair. Would that happen to me? The feeling slowly began to come back in my leg. I was never so relieved. Every day I went for a stroll around the neighborhood. One area known as Picardy Circle had a beautiful pond in the back. I walked around the circle over and over. I began to know it better than my own house. For 6 weeks, the walk was my only exercise. I wasn't allowed to sit in a car until I went to see Dr. Schaefer for a checkup. Doug and Jerry reached out every so often, which I appreciated, while my brother Jimmy kept me company until I could manage on my own. As I look back, the operation was a godsend. Not just because it alleviated the pain and allowed me to resume my career, but because it set me on a new training regimen I would adhere to from then on. If you want to play this game for a long time, Dr. Schaefer said, you are going to have to work on your back and keep it strong. Every summer, whether my back was hurting or not, I underwent therapy for 2 months before heading to training camp. I kept my hamstrings loose and worked on the small muscles around the spine that are often ignored. The operation served as a reminder. For a professional athlete, there can never be too many. Take care of your body. If you do not, it will not take care of you. Even so, the Bulls would have to start the 1988-89 season without me. I wasn't the only one missing. So was Charles Oakley, Ship to the New York Knicks for center Bill Cartwright the day before the draft. I knew how the NBA worked. Teams demanding loyalty from their players while rarely showing it themselves in return. And there had been rumors Oak was on the trading block. I was stunned nonetheless. Oak was the first player traded whom I was close to. The fanciest is nothing more than pawns on a giant chessboard, never giving any thought to the tight relationships we are forced to give up when we are sent, without our consent, to another city. That doesn't usually happen in other professions. Imagine how you would feel if you showed up at work one day and your boss said, "Hey, Johnny, I hate to break it to you like this, but the company has decided to transfer you to Buffalo. Your flight leaves at 8. Have a nice life." I called Oak right away. "Hey, man, I'm sorry. I can't believe they traded you." He couldn't believe it either. Trading Saddle was one thing. He was a backup. Backups, with all due respect, are expendable. Oak wasn't a backup. He was one of the cornerstones of the franchise. As Michael, who had lost his closest friend on the team, put it, "We're giving up the best rebounder in the league. How are we going to replace that?" Good question. Rebounding wasn't the only thing we were losing. Oak was a leader in a way MJ could never be. Every team needs a Charles Oakley, someone who would die for you. On his way out the door, Oak criticized the organization for not giving him the proper respect. I knew exactly how he felt. On the other hand, we have to give Jerry Krause the benefit of the doubt. He wasn't the NBA Executive of the Year in 1988 for nothing. We sorely needed scoring from the low post. The center position meant something in those days, with such outstanding bigs as Hakeem Olajuwon, Moses Malone, Robert Parrish, Patrick Ewing, and of course Kareem, who was still a threat at age 41. Our center was Dave Corzine. God bless him, but Dave was not a threat. In the 1987-88 season, Dave averaged just over 10 points, and a good portion of the points came from the outside. The problem was more glaring than ever in the Detroit series. Over the 5 games, Dave scored only 25 points. In all likelihood, Bill would be a significant upgrade. He had averaged more than 20 points a game in each of his first 2 seasons with the Knicks. Our top pick in the 1988 draft, Will Perdue, from Vanderbilt, played the position as well. Meanwhile, Horace was developing into a superb rebounder and defender. He was more than ready to take over for Oak. The question regarding Bill was his durability. He missed the entire 1984-85 season because of a foot injury and appeared in just 2 games the following year and 58 games the year after that. We didn't get off to a good start in the fall of 1988, losing by 13 on opening night to the Pistons in Chicago. Horace finished with only 2 rebounds. Over the first 2 weeks, our record was 4-4. The Pistons were 7-0. Bill, to put it mildly, didn't appear to be the answer to our problems in the post. He had bad hands, couldn't spot open teammates when he was double-teamed, and was unable to keep up with our speed, the best in the league. Michael wasn't pleased. That also was putting it mildly. He told the rest of us to stop passing the ball to Bill in the last few minutes of a game. Bill was a smart guy. He saw what was going on. He was ready to kill Michael, and I didn't blame him. "That motherfucker," Bill said one day when Michael wasn't around. "I don't care what that fucker says. Just get me the fucking ball." "You got it," I told him. Meanwhile, the word was that I wouldn't return to the lineup until early December. It had to be sooner. I couldn't afford to fall behind Brad for the 2nd year in a row and spend more time on the bench. I had spent too much time there already. I came back on November 18th against the Atlanta Hawks at the stadium. With us about to embark on a long road trip, it made sense to see how my back would hold up. If I was still in pain afterward, I could continue my rehab at our facility in Deerfield and join the team later on the trip or wait until it returned. I checked in with roughly 4 minutes to go in the first quarter. I felt like a rookie again. The jitters, the sense of wonder, the desire to prove I belonged, all of it. I thought I would be on the court for 15, maybe 20 minutes. Make it 35. Doug asked me a few times if I was tired. I was not. I was energized. With every possession, every touch, I became more comfortable, almost as if I had never been away. My numbers for the evening? 15 points, 9 rebounds, 5 assists, and 1 huge steal. The team was trailing by 3 points with around 30 seconds to go when I stripped the ball from Moses Malone as he was driving to the hoop. We scored to cut the lead to 1 and ended up winning in overtime. I approached this game like any other, focusing on the fundamentals, setting a screen, boxing out my man, taking a charge, etc. Though every so often when play stopped, I found myself thinking about the days after the operation, when my fears got the best or worst of me. I felt incredible joy to run up and down the court without any pain shooting through my spine. In late December, when we took on the Knicks at the stadium, I hit the game winner, a jumper from near the free throw line. Michael had driven to the hoop, but his shot was blocked by Ewing, and after Horace missed the follow-up, I found myself in the right place at the right time. By this point, I was in the starting lineup, replacing Brad for good. He would be traded to Seattle in June of 1989. Even with the victory, we were only 14-12, sitting in fifth place in the Central Division. A season filled with high hopes was slipping away. I don't mean to place too much blame on Doug Collins. We were the ones missing shots and missing assignments, not him. Yet he was the same old Doug, harder on us than he needed to be, and that didn't help. When a team struggles, the coach has to be patient, making sure the players keep believing in themselves, regardless of how many losses pile up. The key is to emerge from those struggles before it ruins the whole season. We made it safely to the other side, all right, winning 6 straight in January, 5 straight a month later. Those wins, however, would prove to be misleading. The underlying problems that had plagued the team since training camp hadn't suddenly gone away. Doug continued to defer to Michael, who kept throwing up too many shots. That didn't sit well with Tex. You could make the most acrobatic move in the world and dunk the basketball like Dr. J, and Tex would be fuming you didn't make another pass. He preferred a great pass to a great move. Anything else, in his opinion, was showboating. Every day he would tell us, "Don't be a horse's ass." Translation, make the right play. Just because you beat your man off the dribble doesn't mean your shot is the best shot. The best shot might be the guy who is standing in the corner or cutting in the lane. Except Doug wasn't listening to Tex. That was another big mistake. Think about it. Here was someone in Tex Winter who had been around the game of basketball for more than 40 years as a coach and teacher, and you're not interested in soaking up every ounce of knowledge he has. In what world, please tell me, does that make any sense? Tex, we used to say, has forgotten more about the game than we could ever learn. To top it off, this was only Doug's 3rd season as a head coach in the NBA. As a head coach, period. The conflict between these 2 strong-willed personalities was never resolved, which didn't just harm their personal relationship, it harmed the whole team. To Doug, the number 1 overall pick in the 1973 draft and an outstanding one-on-one player with the Sixers, basketball was an individual game. To Tex, who never played in the NBA, it was a team game. Doug wanted Michael to do whatever suited him on any possession. Tex wanted Michael to pass the fucking ball. Doug, in front of the whole team, would put Tex down in ways you wouldn't believe. "Do you think Tex is here with us today?" Doug would say. Tex was sitting right there. I felt awful for him. In addition to possessing a brilliant basketball mind, he possessed a gentle soul. He didn't deserve to be treated that way. No one does. It got to the point where Tex wasn't allowed to sit on the bench during games. At practices, he stood by himself in the corner of the gym, taking notes. How humiliating. Sometimes it took every ounce of self-restraint for me not to punch Doug in the mouth. That is one fine I would have been happy to pay. Tex, on the other hand, showed up at practice day after day, as if nothing were going on between the two of them. I don't know how he did it. Why, you may wonder, didn't Jerry Krause do something about the way Doug was treating Tex? Jerry idolized Tex Winter. He was the one who brought him here. Nothing escaped Jerry's attention, on or off the court. I don't have a good answer. Though in the end, Jerry did do something about Doug Collins. Something quite drastic. Phil, meanwhile, was gaining respect with each passing day. Joining the team the same time I did, Phil started at the bottom, behind Tex and Johnny Bach, another assistant coach. He wouldn't stay there for long. He was too knowledgeable. Everyone could see that. He possessed one skill Doug couldn't master in a million years. Phil could communicate. What impressed me the most were the scouting reports he gave on upcoming opponents. Phil took the teams that were far from Chicago, while Tex and Johnny, both a lot older, went on shorter trips. Phil's reports were filled with tons of details, large and small. Which side of the floor players preferred to operate from, which hand they liked to dribble with, where any of them might be a little soft on the defensive end, which plays the opposing coach would usually run at different stages in the game. On and on it went. The only detail Phil didn't share with us was what the other team ate for breakfast. I'm sure he knew. Doug felt threatened by Phil, with good reason. Jerry wouldn't have brought in someone with Phil's credentials. He won a title coaching the Albany Patroons in the CBA, which used to be pro basketball's minor league, and two as a player with the Knicks, to be an assistant coach forever. One night in mid-December of 1988, Doug was kicked out of a game against the Bucks in Milwaukee. Phil took over and ran a full-court press and let the guys have more freedom on offense instead of going with the plays Doug preferred. Doug was always coming up with a new play for everyone to learn at practice, in many cases copying ones that had worked against us the night before. Having Phil in charge was a refreshing change. We outscored the Bucks in the second half, 66-38. To win going away. When Doug found out that Phil's wife June had sat next to Jerry and his wife Thelma at the game, he was beside himself. He was insecure enough as it was. He went to see Phil. They talked for hours. Doug was concerned with how tight Phil and Jerry were becoming. Jerry, as it turned out, had been meeting with Phil every so often to get a better sense of how Doug was coping with the pressures of the job. "How did it go with him today?" Jerry would ask Phil. "How did he take the loss?" "Not very well, I suspect." Once on the bus after a tough loss, Doug told the driver to stop. "Let me out. I'll see you guys back at the hotel." During the 1988-89 season, Jerry called Phil while he was on a scouting trip in Miami. Jerry worried Doug's temperament might worsen if Phil wasn't around to defuse the situation. "I don't want you to ever be that far away from the team," Jerry told Phil. "If you have to do any scouting, it has to be on your day off." We dropped 8 of our last 10 heading into the playoffs to finish 47-35. That wasn't exactly the momentum we were looking for. Our health was partly to blame. Horace was having trouble with his wrist, while Brad, Michael, John Paxson, and I we're dealing with one aggravating injury or another. Craig Hodges, the shooting guard we had acquired from the Phoenix Suns in December, was also at less than 100%. Two of those eight losses were to the Pistons, one to the Cavaliers, who for the second year in a row would be our opponent in the opening round. The Cavs were vastly improved. They won 57 games, 15 more than the year before, including each of the six meetings with us. Brad Doherty was developing nicely, while Mark Price and Ron Harper were among the best guard tandems in the league. Magic predicted the Cavs would be the team of the 90s. Maybe the 90s had arrived ahead of schedule. Maybe not. We took Game 1 in Cleveland, 95-88, Michael leading the way with 31 points. I chipped in with 22, while Horace finished with 13 points and 13 boards. To win a playoff game on the road was a huge step for us. During the regular season, our record away from the stadium was an abysmal 17-24. On the road, you need to be smart with the rock, take high percentage shots, avoid unnecessary fouls, and out-hustle your opponent for the all-important 50-50 balls. Check, 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 and check. It helped that Price was out with a strained hamstring. With him returning to the lineup, the Cavs held serve in Game 2, 95-88. Harper was sensational. 31 points, 11 rebounds, 5 steals. The team split the next two games in Chicago. The Game 4 loss was tough to digest. With 9 seconds to go, Michael was on the free throw line with a chance to extend the lead to 3 points. He made the first, but missed the second. The Cavs tied it with 2 free throws from Doherty and 1 in overtime to set up a deciding Game 5 in Cleveland. What happened at the end of that game, I probably don't have to tell you. Here it goes anyway. With 3 seconds left, Brad Sellers throws the ball inbounds to Michael, who has finally broken free. Craig Elo was guarding him. Michael takes 2 dribbles toward the foul line, then rises in the air, double clutches, and fires away from about 18 feet. Nothing but net. A game and series is won. A legend is made. I have nothing against the shot. How could I? Whenever they show it on TV, it brings back the most wonderful memories. Given the circumstances and what was at stake, I can't think of another player in the history of our sport who would have done what Michael did. That's how incredible that moment was, and always will be. Yet when I think about that series, I don't focus on Michael's heroics. I think about what the Chicago Bulls accomplished as a group. It being the first hurdle we cleared to put us on the path to eventually winning a championship. Every team on the rise to reach the promised land needs to come through in a defining moment. When you no longer believe you are destined for greatness, you know it. In the next series, we knocked off the Knicks in 6. Another hurdle for sure. Then in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals, we shocked the Pistons 94-88 in their building. A third hurdle? Hardly. Lambeer and the other thugs rebounded to win Game 2, then grabbed 2 of the next 3 to go up in the series 3-2. Not once did we crack the 100-point barrier. Their strategy was the same as it had been for the last year or so. The famous Jordan rules. Chuck Daly, the Detroit coach, came up with the rules after Michael embarrassed the Bad Boys in April of 1988 by scoring 59 points in a game on national TV. The rules were fairly straightforward. Put 2 or 3 guys on Michael whenever he comes into the lane. Knock his butt to the floor. Throw him in front of a train if need be. Bottom line, do whatever it takes to keep him from going airborne. Once he does that, forget it. In their judgment, and they weren't wrong, one man, as dangerous as he might be, can't possibly beat 5 men. Maybe in 1 game. Maybe 2. Not over a 7-game series. Michael wasn't the only victim. In Game 6, moments after Isaiah Thomas, their star point guard, made a jumper for a 2-0 lead, I caught an elbow in the right eye from Lambeer underneath the basket. It was an accident, I think. One could never be sure with that guy. I was knocked unconscious. After sitting on the bench for a few minutes to clear my head, I wanted to go back in. The doctor said no. Jerry Krause didn't object. I was taken to the hospital with a mild concussion and missed the rest of the game. Even without me in the lineup, we rallied from 10 down early in the fourth quarter to narrow the deficit to 81-79. In the end, Thomas couldn't be contained. He scored 33 points, 17 in the fourth, the Pistons prevailing 103-94. Their bench came through as usual, which included 9 points and 15 rebounds from Dennis Rodman. Were we frustrated? Not entirely. We knew we weren't at their level. Not yet. The talent was there, no question. What the Pistons possessed, and we did not, was a sense of when to be patient and when to attack. You don't acquire that wisdom just from listening to your coaches or reading the scouting reports. You acquire it on your own, from playing in the big games, from losing the big games. Once the season was over, the guys went their separate ways to get a break from the game and from one another. From the first week of October to the first week of June, we had spent more time with our teammates than our families. I took off for Hamburg. I was overseeing the new home that was being built for my parents. Mom wasn't too keen about moving, so instead I had some landscaping done to put in a large ranch-style house, along with a new park and homes for other family members. In early July came big news from Chicago. Doug Collins was out. I'd gotten used to teammates being traded. Getting rid of a coach was something else entirely. A coach who, whatever one thought of him, had just taken his team to the Eastern Conference Finals. Could this really be happening? Oh, yes, it could. And the more I thought about it, the more it occurred to me. What took them so long? The catering to Michael, the criticism of players in front of the fans, the running up and down the sidelines. This wasn't how to unite a group of 12 men with 12 distinct personalities into a unit ready to compete for a championship. That we would start the upcoming season with 3 rookies drafted in the first round, Stacey King, number 6, B.J. Armstrong, number 18, and Jeff Sanders, number 20, might also have factored into the decision. Doug wasn't exactly the nurturing type. Even so, I harbor no ill feelings toward Doug. Whenever I ran into him over the years, I wished him well. He just wasn't the right man to take the Chicago Bulls to the next level. That man was Phil Jackson. I wasn't surprised when Jerry Reinsdorf and Jerry Krause handed the job to Phil. I don't believe anyone was. I can't remember what Phil said to everyone when we got together at training camp in the fall of 1989. I can definitely remember how I felt. That everything would be different. That the Chicago Bulls would be a team, and no longer the Michael Jordan Show. Chapter 7. Phil in the Void. Phil wasn't a star in his playing days. Not even close. From 1967 through 1980, he appeared in 807 regular season games, almost entirely with the Knicks, coming off the bench in the vast majority of them. Phil was what we refer to as a role player. On the Knicks, his role was to throw his wiry frame around and scrap for every loose ball. He scooped up more than his share, his body still paying the price. New York had plenty of guys who could put the ball in the basket, such as Willis Reed, Walt Frazier, and Earl Monroe. That wasn't enough. Like any franchise hoping to make a serious run at a championship, the Knicks needed to impose their will physically, which was what Phil and Dave DeBuscher, their rugged power forward, did nightly. The Knicks, who won it all in 1970 and 1973, defeating the Lakers on both occasions, were known for their unselfishness. No team over the last 50 years has passed the ball with as much purpose. It was a clinic in how the game should be played. Their individual and team defense was another sight to behold. Phil saw absolutely no reason why the Bulls couldn't be like those Knicks teams. Heading into the 1989-90 season, something had to be done. As good as we weren't good enough to beat the Pistons. Fortunately, having been an assistant coach for 2 years and seeing where Doug had gone wrong, fill in the blank, Phil knew precisely which changes to implement from day one. The most important change was to convince Michael he needed to score less for us to succeed. That would be like asking Picasso to paint fewer portraits. Michael was the most prolific scorer the game had ever seen, with the exception of Will Chamberlain. To suggest Michael wasn't enamored with the idea would be a massive understatement. He was concerned that changing the offense would keep him from being Michael Jordan. He had led the league in scoring the previous 3 seasons, averaging 31.1, 35.0, and 32.5 points per game. Many of those points came with him in isolation or on a fast break, the rest of us in as much awe as the fans. Now he would have to score in a system that would require a word that wasn't in his vocabulary. Trust. He would have to trust his teammates to get him the ball where he wanted it, and he would have to trust them to come through when he was double-teamed, and they ended up with open looks. The problem, as he saw it, was they hadn't done enough to earn that trust. Take Bill Cartwright. A year had gone by since Michael told us to stop throwing the ball to Bill in crunch time, and it didn't appear anything had taken place to change his mind. If Michael's goal was to win championships like Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, the main two players he measured himself against, he would have to trust his teammates. He might win a ton of games, as well as more scoring titles and MVPs. He had won one so far from the 1987-88 season by taking around 25 shots every night. He wouldn't win a ring. From day one, Tex had wanted us to run the triangle offense. Only Doug wasn't a believer. Phil couldn't have been more of a believer, as was Jerry Krause. It wouldn't surprise me if Phil, in those occasional private meetings with Jerry, had given him the impression that he would run the triangle if he was put in charge. The offense was similar to how the Knicks shared the ball under Phil's former coach and mentor, Red Holtzman. So what exactly is the triangle? To begin with, the name comes from the triangle that is formed when three players line up on the strong side of the floor. The strong side is where the ball is presently located. The system is complicated at first. No wonder it took us a year and a half to get it down pat. Some players never get it. It wasn't like the offense we were used to running, that's for sure, where someone, usually the point guard, calls out a set play. Instead, the triangle is an offense that reacts to the way the defense is set up. If the defense, for example, takes away a pass to the corner or a dribble penetration, that will automatically open up other options. Your job is to understand almost instinctively what those other options are, and that's where it gets confusing. You are luring the defense into a trap. To put it in boxing terms, the triangle, known for years as the triple post offense, is the perfect counterpunch. The triangle deviated so fundamentally from how each of us learned how to play the game that for the longest time, Michael wasn't the only one who had doubts it could work. Why, if it was so ingenious, were no other teams running it? In the past, players focused only on where they themselves were on the court. Now they would have to keep track of where everyone else was, and that's a big difference. Whoever has the ball in the triangle is like a quarterback in football, who must quickly read the defense and spot open receivers. The goal is for every player on the court to read the defense the same way. You can see where that would be a problem if one man reads it differently from the rest and makes the wrong pass or moves to the wrong spot. The shot clock will wind down, usually resulting in a low percentage shot. Now for the upside. Once you get it down, the triangle will create excellent scoring opportunities. In every game, The goal is to get as many uncontested shots as you can. We used to tell ourselves that after the third pass during any possession, the defense will begin to break down. Our poor grasp of the system was obvious from the start. Guys had trouble getting used to the idea they didn't have to dribble after catching the ball. When they threw a pass, the defense read where the ball was going, as if it had an informer on the inside. We were driving a car with a flat tire, and there was no spare. In the first half hour of practice, Tex went over one fundamental after another. I felt as if I were back in high school. Two-hand chest passes, bounce passes, passes to the post, passes to the elbow. During some practices, he didn't allow us to put the ball on the floor. He wanted to see ball movement and player movement and nothing else. Tex believed in what he referred to as the four pass. That meant making a minimum of four passes in every possession before someone could take a shot. Were we a professional basketball team or appearing in a remake of Hoosiers? I kept waiting for Gene Hackman to show up. We practiced throwing passes from every spot on the floor, knowing one of us might get stuck there in a game and not know what to do next. In a typical 48-minute game, Tex explained, the most any player, including MJ, would have the ball in his hands would be about 4.5 minutes. Given so little time to operate, it would be natural to assume Michael couldn't be as dangerous. It would also be wrong. He was more dangerous without the ball, moving around screens, catching it in rhythm, ready to attack. Because teams were used to guarding him with the ball, they had a game plan. Guarding him without the ball can be more difficult, especially when the defensive player is rotating over as the help defender. Michael would hold on to the ball for 5 seconds at most before he took a jump shot, drove down the lane, or dished it to another player. He wasn't James Harden holding the ball for an interminable 10 or 12 seconds. Sometimes when I watched Harden play for the Houston Rockets, bouncing the ball up and down 20 feet from the basket, I felt as if my life were passing me by. I wanted to shout at the TV, "For God's sake, James, stop dribbling." At the outset of the 1989-90 season, we lost games we should have won. After wrapping up a 7-game road trip in November, our record was a mediocre 7-6. Learning the triangle was similar to learning a foreign language. Just when we thought we had it down, we started to have trouble again. A few of us were hoping Phil might change his mind and scrap the whole thing. Now I could see why Doug had never been a convert. Not a chance. "This is what we are going to do," Phil told us, "and you guys are going to have to figure it out." Through sheer repetition, we did just that. Guys felt more confident in the holes they spotted in the defense and stopped second-guessing themselves. Maybe winning, we went 14-3 from late November through early January, made us believers. Or maybe believing in the system made us winners. Who knows? Who cares? Either way, I fell in love with the triangle. Every player on the court touched the ball on just about every possession, all feeling they were part of the offense, whether they took the shot or not. Working together, we learned to value and trust one another. The players who believe in one another and sacrifice for one another are the players who win championships. Phil was critical in a constructive way. He didn't embarrass us in front of our fans or teammates. He pulled guys off to the side or asked one of the assistant coaches to explain what we did wrong. I felt respected as a player, and more important, as a man. I didn't go along with some of the Zen stuff he introduced to the team, such as the burning of sage and having us close our eyes and meditate. "Sorry, Phil, I know you meant well. That was just way too out there for a country boy like me." Nor did I read the books he handed out every year as presents. On the other hand, I totally bought into what he was saying about a basketball team being a pack and not a collection of separate individuals. More than X's and O's, that was Phil Jackson's most valuable contribution to the Chicago Bulls. He got us to bond, to be one. Instead of going directly from the hotel to the arena for practice, he mixed things up on occasion by taking the team on a tour of the DC landmarks or to visit the Statue of Liberty. There is a fine line between spending enough time with your teammates away from the court and spending too much time with them. Phil was a player for many years. He knew where the line was. As for the X's and O's, while Tex ran the offense in practice, Johnny Bock ran the defense. Johnny doesn't receive enough credit for our success. He had been close to Doug. Phil kept him around regardless, and it was one of the smartest things he did. Johnny was highly respected by the players and knew defense as well as anyone else in the league. He was aware of what the other team was going to do before they were. Phil trusted Tex and Johnny and Jim Clemens, the other assistant coach, to do their jobs. Not every coach in the NBA is that secure. His back bothered Phil so much. He couldn't stand in one place for more than a few minutes. He walked around the perimeter of the court, chiming in every so often with a suggestion that made me think about my role in a whole different way. I learned how to let the game come to me and not force the action if the opportunity didn't present itself. Instead of driving recklessly into the lane, I would pull up and take the mid-range jumper. Our practices were often more intense than the actual games. Being on the first unit, Michael and I played on the same team. We worked on our timing and execution. Every so often, Phil put me with the second unit to go against Michael, Horace, and the other starters. I relished the challenge, and I wasn't alone. So what if it was only practice? To beat a team that had Michael was a chance for the guys on the second unit to prove themselves. When they did win, they gained a ton of confidence. I believe that's why they came up big during that amazing fourth quarter run in Game 6 of the 1992 Finals. The group that outplayed the Blazers for those vital 3 or 4 minutes was the same group that used to, on occasion, defeat Michael's team in practice. They knew they could do it. My strategy in guarding him was no mystery. Force him to drive away from the basket into what is known as help. That's where another defender switches from the player he is covering to help out. It was Michael Jordan. He wasn't passing the ball. He guarded me the same way. Both of us became better at that end of the court from defending the other. Phil didn't push us too hard, especially when guys reached their 30s. He saved our legs for when it counted. The practices were structured. Every movement, every drill, having a purpose. Go hard, go short, make it productive, he told us. That was another part of the man's genius. By the time the game got underway, we couldn't wait to unleash the energy that we had kept bottled up. As much as he believed in the triangle, Phil believed in something else even more. Winning. If that meant dispensing with ball movement and player movement in the fourth quarter of a tight game, so be it. The offense would revert back to when Doug was in charge. Translation, give the ball to Michael. The rest of you, get the hell out of the way. More often than not, that spelled trouble for opponents who had focused for 3.5 quarters on the triangle. Now they had to abruptly change their entire strategy to focus on stopping one player, and not just any one player. Good luck. In January of 1990, I was named to the All-Star team for the first time. Chosen as one of the Eastern Conference's 7 reserves, I was on the same unit with such stars as Larry Bird, Patrick Ewing, and Dominique Wilkins. And of course, Michael. I couldn't have been more excited and grateful. When I underwent the back surgery in the summer of 1988, I wasn't thinking about playing in an All-Star game someday. I was hoping to play in any game. The All-Star game was held in Miami. I scored 4 points and had 1 rebound, 1 steal, and 1 blocked shot. The highlight of the weekend was the slam dunk contest, where I finished 5th. I got the crowd going with my first attempt from the free throw line, receiving a score of 47.2 out of 50, then missed my 2nd when I went for a more difficult 360-degree turn. Oh well. Simply to be in the same competition with Dominique, one of the most spectacular dunkers of all time, was enough. I was involved in another competition back then, which Michael and I came up with one day. For most steals in a season, we figured it would be a healthy battle, a way to get us to concentrate even more on our defense. Phil didn't see it that way. In his opinion, just because a guy received credit for a steal didn't mean he was the player who caused it. More important, whenever you gamble by shooting the gap to steal the ball and don't succeed, the team might then be exposed to a wide open shot or dribble penetration. He had a point. In any case, as I later found out, it was never a fair fight. Not because Michael was a better defender, heavens no. It was because Michael was better at getting people to do whatever he wanted. I saw it over and over, from the first training camp in 1987 to the last victory rally in 1998. Here's how it worked. Say I deflected the ball and tapped it over to him. I should get credit with the steal, right? Nope. More often than not, the steal went into his column on the stat sheet, and I could do nothing about it. One night, a scorekeeper came into the locker room after the game to hand the stat sheets to Phil and the coaching staff. The sheet breaks down the points, rebounds, assists, steals, block shots, turnovers, and so on, for everyone who played in the game. I couldn't believe the look the guy gave Michael. See, MJ? We take care of you. No wonder. In the 9 full seasons we played together, he averaged more steals than me in every year except 2. Even so, steals never tell the whole story of a player's impact at that end of the floor. There's no doubt in my mind, I was superior to Michael in both individual and team defense. Of course, because the media believed Michael could do nothing wrong, he was in the running every season for the Defensive Player of the Year award. I was not. I was considered the voice of the defense, the player who directed everyone where to go. My deep voice was perfect for the task, loud enough to be heard above the noise of the crowd and the other players on the court. Some voices get lost out there. Being able to communicate well on the court is often the difference between winning and losing. You need to tell a teammate when his back is turned and the opponent is about to set a screen, or when someone missed a rotation and you have to be the help defender. Defense on our team was about trusting one another every bit as much as the triangle was. Perhaps more. Johnny Bock used to say our defense is on a string, meaning each man is connected to the other 4. If, for example, the rotating man on the back end of defending a screen and roll doesn't move correctly, the whole defense will break down, and the other team will likely score. If it happens once or twice in a game, you can live with it. More often than that, you won't trust the man anymore, and that's a problem. Not taking anything away from the triangle, but it was our defense year after year that gave us our identity. When we applied full court pressure, it wasn't necessarily to force a turnover. It was to get our opponents to run some clock. By the time they got into their offense, they might have 10 or 12 seconds to operate instead of 16 or 18, often resulting in a low percentage shot. I enjoyed playing defense more than offense. I preferred to be the guy who stopped the last shot rather than the guy who made it. When you play defense the right way, you can break the other team's spirit. Players become lost, disoriented. It's a beautiful sight to see. On defense, I could be the man in a way I could never be on offense. Not on a team that had Michael Jordan. Another role I took on had to do with my buddy Horace Grant. He wasn't happy, and that's an understatement. Although he was playing well, Horace wasn't meeting Michael's high expectations. Who could? And Michael, as it was shown over and over with other players in the ESPN doc, wasn't shy about letting him know. As for Horace, I never knew a player more sensitive to any slights, real or imagined. He despised the preferential treatment Michael received from Doug even more than I did. Michael and Horace had gotten into a pretty heated argument after a playoff loss to the Pistons in 1989. Money was also an issue, and with good reason. Horace was earning $320,000, lower than everyone else on the team, with the exception of Ed Neely and Charles Davis, who both played far fewer minutes. In April of 1990, Horace couldn't take it anymore. He went public with a request to be traded. Horace had every right to feel disrespected. Just 24 years old, he was already one of the top power forwards in the league and was only going to get better. The timing could not have been worse. The playoffs were about to get underway. As usual, I was there for him. I told him his big payday would come, and no matter how critical Michael might be, everyone else in that locker room, Phil included, knew we wouldn't win a title without him. He soon stopped asking for a trade. Truth is, by this point, Horace and I had begun to grow apart. While never enough to cause a serious rift, the difference was noticeable to both of us and our teammates. When we arrived at training camp in the fall of 1987, he and I were at a similar spot in our respective journeys, each hoping to make a mark in the game we loved. That was the case throughout our rookie season and the season that followed it. The bond between us remained strong. In the third season, everything changed. I became an all-star and, in the minds of the press and fans, rose to a level just below that of Michael. Horace felt left out. Being a twin, his brother Harvey played for the Washington Bullets. Horace believed everyone should be equal. Whenever I joined Michael for what I thought was an innocent game of cards, he saw it as a betrayal. That I was trying to be like Mike. I wasn't trying to be like Mike. I was trying to get along with every player on the team, from Michael to the last man on the bench. As Phil told us over and over, we would need everyone to contribute if we were going to do what we failed to do in 1988 and 1989, to beat the fucking Pistons.